Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 117 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm your host, Max Flight, and with me are a couple of co-hosts. First, Rob Mark, the man with bold opinion from the Jetwine blog, is with us. Hey, Rob.
Hey, good evening. Good evening from Chicago, where we finally had to turn the heat on this morning. I mean, so I guess that means summer is really gone.
It is for us. Now, Steve and Grant are enjoying the start of their summer, so they have the advantage.
Yeah, we're going to work on that, though. I heard their wind-up for the show tonight, so they've got some very interesting topics to talk about. Very seasonal topics down there.
Ah, very good. Also here is David Vanderhoof, who blogs at What Just Flew By. David's our resident aviation historian and military aviation expert. Hi, David.
Hey, Max. We had our last day of summer yesterday. I and my wife got to drive down to Delaware to spend some afternoon soaking up rays and absorbing the sun while the C-5s and the C-17s drifted ever so gracefully overhead.
Sounds great.
Today we're at 60 degrees and gloomy, and I guess Rob's right, fall's here.
Yeah, well, the one thing that's not here is Dan Webb. Dan is off today, but we'll look forward to seeing him next week.
Oh, yeah, sure we will. I mean, yeah, sure, we will.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all about intonation.
Our guest this episode is Stephen Frischling, who goes by Fish. He writes the Flying with Fish blog, and he's also the founder of The Travel Strategist, which I guess, Steve, helps businesses use travel effectively and efficiently. Is that a good way to describe The Travel Strategist?
I have no idea what my job description is anymore. It's one of those. I'm a little from A, a little from B, and somewhere in the middle I make a living.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. Well, it's good to have you back. Steve was last with us. I don't remember what episode that was, but it was a little while ago. So good to have you back, Fish.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, coming up, we've got aviation news from the past week. We also have some more interviews by David from the 2010 Oceania Air Show. And, of course, we've got the Australia Desk report from Steve and Grant. But first, let's get started with the aviation news. You guys ready?
Sure.
Let's rock it.
First story comes from Bloomberg Businessweek. Bombardier to launch new large business jet. So Bombardier Aerospace has approved the launch of a large business aircraft, according to this article, to help fend off competition from the rival Gulfstream in their new flagship business jet, the G650. Guy Hatchie, the Bombardier Aerospace president, says, "Our intention is to grow our leadership position, and the time is right to move forward with our extended global aircraft family." So, Rob, is this the right time for Bombardier?
Oh, sure, so long as they have the money. I think what's really interesting about this is that people are still wondering what happened to the C-Series on the airline side. And so I think a number of people were really surprised, in a way surprised that they made the announcement now. But I think everyone's been wondering what the follow-on to the large aircraft that Bombardier has already were going to be. I mean, the Challenger's getting pretty old. It's been around for 25 years, and in fact, actually longer than that, I think, now. So this ought to be very interesting. Of course, they didn't release any details about what it's going to look like, but I'm headed to the NBAA show, the convention down in Atlanta week after next, and so we'll probably get some briefings on it down there, I think. But right now, it's a bit of a mystery as to what it's actually going to look like or what the size of it's going to be.
If we can get a C-Series with the Olympus engines from the Concorde, it'd be great.
So you want a supersonic C-Series?
Well, you know, if I can get that and I can park it in my backyard, I wouldn't complain.
Yeah.
By the way, how many power lines do I have under my road? Can I get down the street? No, maybe not. So.
Yeah. It's funny, though. I mean, you look at all the issues. I mean, of course, Cessna had a wide body, a large cabin aircraft that was going to be a follow-on. And they canceled it about 18 months ago when the economy really started to tank.
Right.
And so, of course, Gulfstream's been at the 650 for quite some time. Hawker's had the 4000, which has been in development, because it's not really an ultra long range airplane, but you know that's their newest airplane. But so you know these new ones are coming by leaps and bounds, or not leaps and bounds, by dribbles actually. But it's no small event to build another airplane. But of course, if Bombardier is going to be competitive when the market is already in the midst of being turned around, they're going to have to start now. So in that sense, I guess it really isn't too strange to see this happen.
Hey, Rob, what size class are we talking about? How many people, for us ignorant military aviation geeks, what are we talking about as far as size goes?
Well, if people are familiar with the size of the Bombardier's Global Express, which is, let me think, what does that carry? 14, I think, 14 or 15 or something like that. But that's an intercontinental, ultra long range airplane. And they're thinking that this new one may be about 20% larger than that. And but of course, you know, again, the range to be competitive, it's going to probably have to be in the 6,000 mile range category to really make it competitive. That's a long time. That's a lot of flying.
I had done a project with Bombardier this summer actually, and I spent a lot of time.
I remember we were talking about that.
I don't want to say I was spending my free time sleeping on a Global 5000, but you know the option was a metal fold up chair or sleeping on a Global 5000. So I would go and sit on the plane. Yeah. Plus the food was a lot better. But if I recall correctly, the Global Express, because there's the 5000 and the XRS. I believe the XRS can hold between 19 and 20 passengers.
Will it hold that many? Well, that's great.
I believe people have them configured for like 10.
Mm, yeah.
Because, you know, if I got mine, I'd have it configured for 5 people and just a really big skating rink up the middle. But that's why I would do it.
Okay.
But, yeah, I only have it configured for 1. The dog. Because that'd be up front.
You'd be up front flying it.
So, anyway.
Okay, moving on to our next story. This comes from Aviation Week by Max Kingsley Jones. This is EADS to rule on Airbus A320 Neo decision. So the EADS board members are scheduled to meet in the middle of October to decide whether or not they're going to launch a re-engining of the A320 series aircraft. And if they do, this is being called the new engine option, NEO, or I guess Neo. The leadership team of Airbus has decided that they're going to take this to the board. One of the big issues in looking at whether or not this was feasible, according to this article, was whether or not Airbus had enough engineering resources to launch on a new effort. And this is a project that, if it does go, they would expect it to cost between $1.3 and $2 billion. So this is, I guess, the next step, one more step in this sort of interesting saga of what are Airbus and Boeing going to do?
Yep, sure is.
I think the new engine is pretty interesting, but I hate to say more than the new engine for Airbus. I like Boeing's patent for getting rid of the 737 instead. Of course, they're totally different aircraft with different markets, not really, but I just like saying that because it sounds better. Have you guys seen the twin aisle for the 737?
Yes, we talked about the Boeing patent last episode. Yeah, this is the twin aisle kind of super guppy type of shape.
To me, it looks like a BAE-146 that's been sort of shoved oddly in a different direction with a lowered wing, but that's a whole different version. I'm curious how the two are going to work if one gets a new engine and one gets a new plane.
Yeah, it's very confusing, and I still think it's quite likely that there's a significant amount of posturing going on right now, and it's hard to tell what's real, what's a smokescreen. No one wants to tip their hands too soon, but it's kind of getting to the point where they're going to have to in order to move forward.
I had to say bring the 727 back and give it better engines.
Yeah, it was a great airplane.
Forget the arguments. Give me a three-holer. Make the third one, you know, for cosmetic purposes because I like the way it looks. Let it go.
Oh, yeah. It was fun.
I used to like that stairway they had down the back where you could run down the back.
Or jump out of.
That's right. Exactly.
With your ransom money, right?
Right, exactly.
I used to board the Eastern Shuttle that way sometimes. Not that I want to sound old. But, well, I've got Rob. I don't need to sound old. But anyway.
Easter. Let's see.
I remember going up the back stairs on a 727, I think, years ago. Sure.
A number of times we boarded at LaGuardia.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There were a couple of times that Jetways didn't work at LaGuardia, and they would just board you up the back of the plane. Hmm. You just don't get that anymore.
What can we do? Well, I think, you know, on this A320 upgrade plan or Boeing's, I think that there are a number of things that have to be in place in order for them to commit to doing that. You know, one is customer demand. If you don't have the customer demand for a new aircraft or a re-engined airplane, you know, it's a non-starter.
Yeah, but aren't all the airlines hounding them for new engines? And I don't think they have to worry about the demand part.
The demand part, I think is covered. The second thing I think that they need is technology, and I mean that kind of broadly. I mean, if they don't have something new to offer, then what's the point? That's also kind of a foundational requirement.
Well, EasyJet had the idea 2 years ago, which was based on the A320, but with turboprops.
Mm. Yeah.
I believe they were rear affixed turboprops, if I recall correctly.
Interesting.
You know, people say that's crazy, but you look at the performance of the Q400 versus a lot of regional jets,
right.
And obviously that's different than the mainline aircraft, but, you know, it's not as crazy as everyone thinks it is.
Yeah.
At least not according to engineers.
Sure. I think we have an abundance of technology these days with regard to new aircraft, new airplanes, new engines, so there's no shortage there. I think the next thing they have to have is funding, is the internal funding. I mean, these things don't come cheap. We just saw the number for something as relatively simple as re-engineering an airplane, which is obviously not as extensive an engineering task as designing a whole new aircraft. But you got to have that internal funding. And Boeing and Airbus have been devoting resources to other issues, other problems, getting other airplanes launched. So funding, that's a big driver in these things. And the last thing I think is manpower resources. And this is what came up with the Airbus discussions over re-engineering the A320. You have to have the engineering staff, you have to have the engineering resources to add a new project. And it's something that the Airbus executives looked at, considered, and it was part of their business case. And I guess they arrived at a conclusion that led them to take it on up to the board.
How much of the re-engineering cost can be handed off to, say, Pratt or Rolls or GE?
Or even outsourcing. I mean, there's another article, seemingly unrelated, in the Economic Times that talks about Airbus is going to double its technical staff in India. They outsource some engineering work. I think engineering analysis and design to a staff in India. And purportedly, that's to support their efforts in the Indian market, but doubling that staff, which is I'm reading is around 180, and they're planning to bring that up to around 400 by 2013. That makes you wonder if they don't have in mind an outsourcing strategy to help with this program. But that's just speculation. Okay, let's move on to a little bit of military action, David. We see in Flight Global, Iraq offered new F-16s with older missiles. So I guess from this article by our friend Stephen Trimble, that Iraq is looking to receive 18 F-16s with a value of up to $4.2 billion. That's probably list price. But they're not going to have the latest missiles, and they're not going to have the latest radar. Is Iraq going to enjoy a previous generation setup? Is that going to bother them at all?
Well, actually, I thought long and hard about this, and actually, if you go to my blog today, I wrote a response to this, that the fact that they're getting new block F-16s with old block hardware, they're getting the mechanically scanned radar, they're also, instead of an AESA radar, which is electronically scanned, and they're getting Sparrows and Sidewinders instead of AMRAAMs and Super Sidewinders or AIM-9Xs. The important part of this is that they're getting, we've granted 18, they want at least three or four squadrons of them, so they want 18, 36, etc. But what's really important is the infrastructure that's going to go with 18 F-16s, late block F-16s.
Uh-huh.
We haven't been really sending them over the latest and greatest hardware. So we're sending them over new block F-16s with older block military hardware. I think basically the argument says is they're too close to terrorist organizations that we don't really want them to have AIM-120s or AIM-9Xs.
Yeah.
The advanced weaponry. But that being said, we're going to have to build a whole infrastructure in Iraq for these F-16s. And that really is an argument that says we have to build an infrastructure for their F-16s. But funny enough, if we ever need to use those bases, the infrastructure will be there. Hmm. So that I think it's a way of getting us into Iran for bases in case there's ever a hostile action again, excuse me, in Iraq in case there's ever a hostile action in Iran, because we will have to, we'll build up all the infrastructure there, yeah, and then we can deploy our own F-16s there without any other problems behind it. The other thing would be is if they just wanted F-16s, we could have pulled a bunch of them out of the boneyard and given them to them.
Hmm.
But they are building late block F-16s, so there's going to be an infrastructure support there, and I might be also the argument that says Lockheed Martin's definitely trying to extend the length of the F-16 production line because the F-35 ain't coming off as quick as it could. But
well, isn't there also an upcoming potential buy for F-16s with India, a rather large one?
The F-16 is in competition with a lot of other aircraft. India wants to completely replace their older force, which consists of mostly Russian or Soviet hardware. The F-16 is one of the competitors. I don't know where it falls in. India is kind of is unique that they decide, and they don't have any problem buying from anybody. So the F-16 is up against the Eurofighter and a lot of other fourth and F-18s, fourth and fifth generation fighters. So it's one way to continue the line in case that ever happens.
Right.
One of the things that I don't see India doing is purchasing F-16s because their primary rival is an F-16 buyer, which is Pakistan. So I can't imagine them purchasing them just because the Pakistanis got them and we don't really want that. There's that sort of inner rivalry there.
Hmm.
David, I wonder who's paying for all these F-16s.
You know, on April 15th, you fill out that form, Rob.
that's exactly what I thought.
The Iraqis are supposedly paying for it, but I have a feeling that there's a lot coming out of our own pockets. And the benefit will be we'll get bases that we can deploy aircraft to. F-16 is really not the issue. It's we'll build bases that we can forward deploy to in case of an emergency against Iran.
Now, David, I got a question for you. This is in two parts. One of which you partially touched upon. One is extending the lifespan of the production cycle of the F-16s. But as you said, why don't we just yank F-16As out of the boneyard and give it to them? For the money they're putting out there, it's worth $4.2 billion. It's a lot of money, but say compared to Saudi Arabia's $60 billion deal with the Defense Department, if they have a terrorism issue, wouldn't F-16As be a better choice because there's less technology for someone to steal and put back out there?
Right, but you gotta look at it like I was saying. It's not about the aircraft, it's about the bases. You build an infrastructure for F-16As. We're not flying in the U.S. Air Force. We're not flying F-16As. We're flying late Block Cs and Ds. Now, they didn't offer them the Block 60s, which are the ones that the United Arab Emirates, which are the super F-16s, but they did build standard late Block U.S. Air Force F-16s. We build those bases with that infrastructure. We can drop our aircraft in there without a problem. And
Makes sense. And we
basically gave them the late block aircraft with the capabilities of an F-16A. I mean, the Jordanians and the Italians and the Portuguese, they love the F-16As. It's a hot rod aircraft, but we're basically downgrading the aircraft, but we're going to build up the infrastructure so that if we ever need it, we can go in there.
Hey, David, can I ask you a listener kind of question that one of our listeners might actually wonder about, because it's something I always wonder about. When you talk about block, the block 50 aircraft or the block 60 aircraft, what does that mean to those of us that may not be that familiar with the military side?
The block is you purchase aircraft in blocks.
It's kind of lots, right? It's like a lot.
It's like a lot. The aircraft over time has changed. And when you get to a certain block of aircraft, you usually put it in specific avionics. In the case of the F-16C, there's the Block 50 and there's the Block 52. The difference between the two is the engines, the Pratt Whitney versus the
GE.
Also, the Block 52 was originally was designed for more of a ground attack version. The Block 50 had different, so they have different avionics. Even though they're both F-16Cs, they're two different airplanes designed for two different missions. Likewise, with the F-18s, like last week, we talked about the Australians buying the F-18F pluses. They're actually buying a block of aircraft that were designed for to be EA-18 Growlers. So you're talking about, say, 20 or 30 aircraft or 150, 200 aircraft where they are part of a long production run, but they have specific features that some other aircraft don't. Does that make sense, Rob?
Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's a good way to define it. Thank you.
They changed over time with improvements, and you have lots and lots and lots of, even though they're all B-24s, Cs, Ds, and they've changed over time. So they're block. You look at block numbers to look at what their specific requirements are, their avionics, what engines they have. It's a way of narrowing down the production line.
Okay, good. Yeah, that's a good question, Rob. Okay, next let's talk about helicopters. From globalair.com, we see Eurocopter X3 begins testing. Company calls it a turboprop-helicopter hybrid. Now, this is something that's maybe kind of a little competition for the Sikorsky X2, but recently Eurocopter showed the world, I guess, the X3. It's a high-speed hybrid, kind of combines VTOL capabilities with a really fast cruise speed. It has a, I guess, pretty much conventional rotor on top, but it's got two sort of short, stubby wings off the sides with propellers that provide a forward speed. And it's kind of an interesting looking vehicle. It's designed to be capable of a speed of about 220 knots, it says. David, I assume you're familiar with the Sikorsky X2.
Yeah, it's a composite helicopter, meaning that it's got a large pusher propeller. Instead of the normal tail rotor that's counteracting torque, the Sikorsky S2 has a large rotor that faces directly back to provide thrust for the aircraft. In this case, you have two wings with propellers.
Right.
Trying to match the performance of something like a V-22, but not you making the tilt rotor thing. You're using both the main rotor and then the propellers for the forward thrust. Kind of like an autogyro, but the main rotor is actually powered. My problem with helicopter is you're definitely not going to do what you normally see out of people who buy helicopters. And that is, while the main rotor's going, you get out of the helicopter and you run off and you do your business meeting. Mm-hmm. These main rotors are right in the middle of right in line of the main doors. So propellers, it's... I don't know if this is really ever going to be a practical helicopter, but it's an interesting concept.
I guess the mission that maybe this and the Sikorsky X2 are trying to chase is sort of high-speed deployment. Is that kind of right?
Yeah, they said long-range and search and rescue missions. I mean, it would be kind of good for a Coast Guard where you can launch quickly from a main base to get out to a ship. And then when you get out there, I guess you shut down the forward thrust rotors so you can actually act like a helicopter and perform your rescue missions. Nowhere in this article does it say whether you keep these forward thrust rotors going at all times or can it operate without them.
Yeah. Ah, well, it's an interesting design. I guess it'll be fun to see where this goes, and also the Sikorsky X2.
Now that we've gone through helicopters, are we going to tankers again? Because, you know, there's not enough tanker stuff ever in the news.
Well, no. We skipped that. I was very happy with that. I wasn't going to say anything.
But we're still looking to a November decision, I understand.
November 2013?
No. 2010. But
yeah, hopefully that when I see it.
We'll see. Yeah, we'll see. Steve, do you have any other news stories you'd like to throw in the hat here?
I do, and I'm not sure which one I find more humorous or serious, and I'm always debating whether it should be a Simpsons episode or not, which would be either Mexicana or Aeroflot. I'm going to go with Aeroflot for alphabetical continuity, which is the other day Aeroflot announced that they will be launching a low-cost carrier and charter airline by 2025. I read the email, and it was one of those, it must be a typo, except that the date appeared three more times in the release.
How can they possibly take that much time to develop an airline?
This is where I come into this one. I look at it, okay, they're absorbing six state-owned carriers. That'll take a year. I'll give them the year, because All Nippon has to build a low-cost carrier within a year, and to acquire new aircraft, so fine, we'll give them the year. But 15 years, I did a breakdown on my blog today where in 15 years, we look at it this way. The Soviet Union only fell 19 years ago. Mm. United Airlines launched TED in exactly 3 months from the day they announced it to the day it actually existed, including almost 57 aircraft with new interiors and liveries. BMI launched BMI Baby in 2 days short of 2 months.
Interesting.
Aeroflot's going to go with 15 years on this one. So, as I mentioned on Twitter, thanks for the heads up. I'll check back in 14 years, 7 months and see where we're at.
I'm not even sure I'll be alive in 15 years.
Who knows what government will exist in 15 years in Russia at this rate. But, the other is Mexicana, which I was on episode 112 talking about.
Right.
They're essentially dead, but not really. They ceased flying on August 18th. Since they ceased flying, they have negotiated contracts with their unions after they've stopped flying. And in the last week, they've started ordering OEM parts from Airbus.
Hmm.
For the life of me, I can't figure out what dead airline is A, retaining their air operator certificates, B, negotiating with aircraft lessors, C, negotiating with their unions, and D, ordering OEM parts from manufacturers.
Doesn't sound very dead, does it?
No, and a number of financial firms say never going to happen. They're never going to fly again. But somebody's putting a lot of money into an airline that people say isn't going to fly again.
Hmm.
And Oneworld will not take them off their website. Oneworld says that they are still a member airline.
Sounds like somebody knows more than they're saying out loud.
I keep trying to find stuff out, but one, my Spanish stinks. And two, talking to them is similar to talking to the Russian government, if I can just tie the two airlines together. it's a lot of, yes, we're ordering parts. Why? Because we have planes. No, you don't. They were taken back. We still have planes. Excellent. Why are you negotiating with your unions? Because we're an airline and we need to have our flight attendants and pilots on board. But you're not flying. But we have pilots and flight attendants. They're being paid.
Okay, you know what this is really all about, though, guys. Come on. This is the key to the Russian charter airline.
Oh.
This is all going to come together here. It's just going to take – the Russians know about the state of the bureaucracy in Russia, and they know that working with the Mexicans, it's going to take a little time. And so they're just adding a little fudge room. But that's where this is all headed. I can see it.
There's a grand
strategy. How do I tie Mayor Daly into this? There's got to be a way to tie Mayor Daly into this. I just don't know how. Give me 10 minutes. I'll come back to that. So,
that's amazing.
Sorry, I shouldn't bring politics into airplanes, because politics never involve the airline industry.
Let's talk about mergers a little bit, since there seems to be an awful lot of merger action going on these days. We saw that the United Continental merger closed just last week.
And Southwest is not a merger. It's a acquisition. Better to be known as Southwest is eating AirTran whole and spitting out the 717s the next couple of years, but they don't want to talk about it.
You see a fundamental difference between Southwest and AirTran versus United and Continental.
Well, large and evil. Large and evil. They make one great airline. Southwest, happy-go-lucky Texan people who have funny accents but a really good sense of business, versus AirTran that's kind of southern, but they're based in Orlando, and despite Orlando actually being in the south, really isn't a southern city. This is why I'm not a diplomat for a living, by the way. So
yeah, we understand.
I was offered a job with the State Department, and then they met me. No. So, but No, I mean, you know, United and Continental, it makes sense. If you look at their map, their global map,
right?
They had so much to gain from each other.
Yeah, a lot of potential synergy there, right?
There were some fleet issues, but the two fleets are so large they can operate independently of each other. It's like Delta, Northwest. There were so many things, if you read airliners.net, and I try not to because you either laugh or tear your hair out. People said the airlines can't merge because look at the fleets. Delta will get rid of the 747s. No, they're not. Delta's getting rid of the Airbuses. No, they're not. You know, it was one of those things like that simply can't happen. But the fleets are so large that under one company, they can operate two different fleets and have no problem because the infrastructure is already there.
Mm-hmm.
That exists with United and Continental. You know, and I'm going to go with the flat-out obvious that everybody says, which is I really hope that United takes on the Continental customer service and customer experience and maintains the I guess it's more like 3.4 classes of service United offers.
Yeah.
I never quite know how to say that. It's not three classes. It's not four classes. It's like 3-point-something classes of service.
Yeah.
Although I will go on record, which is something I have said to United's people standing in their building, which didn't go over so well. The new livery is hideous.
The new livery, huh?
I can't stand it. I know people love it. They like the globe. I happen to like United's logo. You know, the Southwest and the AirTran merger, before I go to the serious business of the Southwest and AirTran merger, the best thing that can come out of that acquisition, because it's not really a merger and I should correct myself, is that the AirTran livery will be abolished.
You don't like that, huh?
I detest that livery. You know? Whenever I fly into Atlanta, I just try to shield my eyes until I get to the Delta gates.
Well, besides,
oh my God, that thing's going by. I need to cover my eyes.
Well, besides the livery issue, when you look at AirTran and Southwest, do you think do you see any challenges for the two of them going forward?
A lot. Corporate culture. Southwest is such a unique brand. AirTran's a pretty good airline. People who fly them are very happy with them.
Sure.
But their culture is not the same as Southwest. And again, it's not a merger. You're not putting two companies together. This is Southwest is swallowing AirTran whole.
So Southwest will then be able to impose their culture on the,
exactly
the AirTran that they
swallow. They're not saying we're not taking the best of both airlines and putting them together. This is Southwest is going in and saying we're taking your fleet, we're taking your routes, and everything that AirTran was is gone.
But
with the exception of Atlanta at 717s.
Yeah, and the pilots in that buyout, the pilots are saying Yahoo. I mean the AirTran pilots, because the AirTran pilots stand to gain a whole lot of money, a huge raise.
When they
blend them. The Southwest guys, the ones I've heard, they're not so keen on the whole thing. But, you know, that's another story.
But correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't AirTran the lamb that walked up to Southwest to be slaughtered? Wasn't AirTran who initiated this little merger or acquisition?
Well, I heard Gary Kelly on the call last week. And I believe it was I have to think about that. I thought it was Gary Kelly that said that he spoke to AirTran CEO and just said they should just talk maybe about working together or you know, blending or something like that. I don't think it was the AirTran people, but I might be wrong on that.
Every time you hear, let's have a conversation in one of these acquisitions or mergers, you know, it's never let's have a conversation. Nobody goes in there saying, let's sit down at the table, we'll have a blitzo, we'll share a Dr. Brown's cherry soda, and we'll talk. It's somebody walks in there with the lawyers and saying, this is what your airline is worth, this is what I've got, where do we stand?
Hmm.
You know, and that's kind of how it is, not just with airlines, with almost every corporation.
That's true.
You walk in there with a whole, nobody wants to have a polite talk. It's going to be, you're in trouble, I'm going to buy you, and this can be peaceful, or I can slaughter you whole. And what gets me with a lot of what we're talking about, and I see it coming up over and over again, and it's incorrect, about did Southwest's unions agree to the 737-800 because of AirTran? And anybody who looks at the airlines knows this. AirTran flies no 737-800s. It doesn't make a difference. And I've seen this written about by experienced people who cover the industry. And it's, oh, well, they saw it coming because they approved the 737-8.
So what? I don't get it. What's the connection there?
There is none, and I keep seeing it showing up in places.
Hmm.
It's one of those that makes a really good soundbite, that the unions knew it was coming because they approved the 737-800. Well, it wouldn't make a difference because there isn't a single one in the fleet.
Right.
They fly 717s, 737s, 700s. The only airline that might have been on the table that really doesn't make any sense is Sun Country, who flies a 737-800, except Sun Country doesn't own its own fleet. So if they had bought Sun Country, they would get Minneapolis. If you're an airline, do you want Minneapolis or Atlanta? You know, look at the gaps in Southwest coverage. This is a monster of an acquisition, essentially, to walk into. They're not just walking into Atlanta. They're walking into Atlanta with 200-plus departures daily.
Right. You know? Yeah, and I agree. And I think, as Fish said before, I mean, the culture issue is no small – that is no small challenge. It's not exactly as, you know, when they picked up, say, Muse Air and there were, you know, eight airplanes or seven airplanes or whatever they had at the time, I forgot, and a few pilots and a few flight attendants. This is a huge, huge acquisition with an airline that was known as the cheapest, not the cheap, but they were known as a cheap airline. I don't mean they operated cheaply, but I'm saying
low-cost, fare-wise.
And Southwest was a low-cost carrier, but one that had a whole culture about it. I don't think anybody knows what the culture of AirTran is, if there is one. But
there really isn't.
They're going to have to change that. Yeah, plus they're also bringing on – they're also doing something they've never done before, which is try to bring on another aircraft. And this is a you know, so –
Well, they have had other aircraft. They have flown DC-9s in the past, but limited leases and very early on in their lifespan.
Yeah, but that was a long time ago. I mean, a long time ago. Now they're going to have quite a few pilots and scheduling it. Oh, this is going to be fun, I think. I think it's going to be fun making this all come together.
You know, one issue I get that seems to be overlooked by almost everybody, and I've spoken to a number of AirTran flyers because I know a couple of guys who were in Baltimore who fly them frequently, and they don't want to go to Southwest as a frequent flyer. Because of the frequent flyer program, it doesn't work for them, and it's one class, and they're used to having the ability to either buy a first class seat, which was pretty cheap on AirTran. Some of the flights were like $30 to upgrade, or get the upgrade for your status. And they don't want to go to an airline that is, you know, they have moved to the ABC, so it's not really a true cattle call, but it's still a cattle call boarding. Mm-hmm. You know, you line up by your group and you get on the plane. They don't want to do that. They want the big seat up front. And does Southwest care that they're losing the people? No, because in the long run, they're getting a lot more people in the door. But somebody's got to be there to pick up the pieces of these frequent flyers from AirTran.
Yeah, yeah, that's an interesting aspect to it. What about other airlines? American Airlines, for example. Reuters has a piece out titled "Rival Mergers Put New Pressure on American Airlines," saying that American Airlines that needs to find a merger partner. They may be kind of losing a competitive position if they, you know, continue to go alone without merging. Any thoughts on that?
I've written about this in the past. It doesn't work. They have two options that keep showing up. One is U.S. Airways. U.S. Airways still isn't over their America-West merge. The infighting at U.S. Airways is substantial. So to have them go and merge into American, that would be a disaster. I mean, purely a disaster. Route map-wise, it'd be great for the East Coast. Europe, they wouldn't gain anything. South America, U.S. picks up Americans. Sort of out west, they're kind of neck and neck on not being the airline you really want to happen on the West Coast, because neither one of them really has that kind of service. So the other option people look at is JetBlue. They can't do JetBlue. It simply can't happen. The whole reason JetBlue exists is because of their cost operating structure. American has one of the highest cost operating structures, JetBlue one of the lowest. If they bring JetBlue into American, well, they've just blown the whole margin there for how JetBlue was able to be profitable.
Yeah.
Not to mention JetBlue is one of the other few airlines that really has a culture. You know, you go into JetBlue and their staff, everybody there has that JetBlue culture. And you're going to bring that into an airline that is constantly mired in labor disputes.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work. You know, not to mention, even though the DOT and the government appears to be letting every merger known to man exist right now, someone would look at that and go, well, who has the most slots at Kennedy? Who has the most slots at LaGuardia? Now we have JetBlue and American at Kennedy, and look at LaGuardia. You know, what are they going to argue? United takes over Newark, except that's New Jersey. Well, it's technically New York. Somebody's going to go ahead and argue that it's a different state, which I always do because I hate New Jersey.
Careful. You'll get hate mail.
No hate mail from the Yankees fan. Anyway, it's a whole issue there. Who are they going to – they have nobody to merge with. U.S. Airways – would have to leave and go to Oneworld. And people say that US Airways being the ugly girl at the dance, essentially, for United and Continental shouldn't stay with Star Alliance. But Star Alliance is very good for US Airways. Oneworld used to bill itself as the top airlines, essentially, in the world. American has all sorts of issues. British Airways, while they're doing okay now, had massive issues about a year and a half, 2 years ago. Mexicana, God knows what's going on with them. JAL, one of the largest bankruptcies in Japan's history, and they still can't figure out what to do with the airline. Why would US Airways go to an alliance with those airlines?
Yeah, you got to ask, right?
You know, the newest member of Oneworld is S7, the only airline attempting to compete with Aeroflot.
Yeah.
And I could go on for 45 minutes on S7 versus Aeroflot, but I'll spare the listeners. Really, it doesn't really make sense for US Airways.
Okay.
Anyone disagree? Anyone? David, you live in Philadelphia. What do you think about, you know, having all blue tails silver?
You know my opinion. I want Southwest to ditch their logo and bring back Little Value Jet with the new merger. So I don't know. I mean, Philadelphia is so bizarre anyway to be the last bastion of U.S. Airways, and now it's they're a minor player at the airport. So it's Southwest, and we had a lot of AirTran flights, and a lot of my family flies AirTran, and they're not happy about losing first class. So it's just weird, and it's not my I just like, as long as the airplanes look pretty and they go by my window, and that makes me happy.
All right, well, let's close out the merger acquisition consolidation topic, I guess. Any other closing comments anyone has on that?
We could just throw Air Canada WestJet out there and see what sticks.
Do you think anything would stick?
No.
No, but it would sound good. And if somebody listened and didn't pay attention to the whole podcast, they'd hear it and go, my God, and start writing about it. And then it'd be funny.
Yeah, good.
So,
Rob, is it all about labor?
Labor, fleet integration. I'm going to go with those two. And as I said, you know, some of the airlines people talk about merging don't own their own aircraft. So why take them?
That's good. Fish, anything else that's going on in your world that we need to touch on before we move on to some other topics?
No, you know, the only thing that really involves my world is June of next year when BMI's frequent flyer program gets absorbed into Lufthansa's Miles and More. But that's a whole rant that we'll just save for when no one's listening.
Okay. All right, good. Well, hey, thanks for joining us. We always love to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right, we have a couple more interviews that David did at the Oceania Air Show. First up, let's do Red Devils. Do you want to set this up, David?
Oceania is kind of unique in that the British parachute team, the Red Devils, comes and jumps every year. They don't get the Golden Knight, not to say that I'm not really fond of the Golden Knights because they gave me a ride this summer, but the Red Devils do multiple jumps during the day. The first part of the morning, they jump out of a C2 Cod, then they jump out of an MH-53 Sea Dragon, but they're also very famous for their night jumps. And one of the things they do is they have their flight suits and they take the Cellulume light sticks, which are those green things you've seen at Halloween. You snap them.
Yeah, right.
And they glow. Well, their flight suits have like spots for like 50 to 100 of them. So they wow. do a night jump out onto Virginia Neptune's Court, which is a beach on Virginia Beach. And on the night we were there, the Saturday night, Crystal night, you basically see these glow-in-the-dark guys falling from the sky and landing on the ground. And then the really cool part that I like so much is they're done with the light sticks. So what they do is they throw them out and all the kids get them.
Oh,
so what you get is Virginia Beach lit by kids running around carrying light sticks, yelling. And for a couple of hours, it's kind of a magical little place all by because of the Red Knights doing their night jump. Excuse me, the Red Devils doing their jump.
All right, let's listen to David's interview.
I'm here with Lance Corporal Danny Kelly of the Red Devils. Danny just jumped in. Danny, how do you like being at Oceania?
Well, being at Oceania is awesome. This is like about the ninth year we've been invited back, and it's just it's a pleasure to be invited and an honor to fly our flag along with yours.
And tell me, the big deal with you guys here at Oceana is jumping out of a C2 cog at night with cellulone light sticks all over your body. What's it like doing those night jumps?
I've done quite a few night displays. I've done quite a lot of displays now in total. However, that one last night onto the beach of Virginia on Neptune Beach, it doesn't get much better than that. Literally flying past the Hilton Hotel with a million cameras going off, it's something else. It's special.
And how long have you been flying with the Red Devils or jumping?
This is my third year. I've been here 2.5 years so far. I really enjoy it. And it's, I'm just proud to fly my country's flag in the States alongside yours.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. You guys are going to go pack your chutes because you're going to jump again. You guys do a lot of jumping at this show. So I really appreciate you taking the time. And I'm sure my British listeners, if you get a chance over in the UK to see these guys, we're lucky to see them once a year here at Oceana, but you can check them out. They're great.
Awesome. Thank you.
Okay, very good. David, what are we going to listen to next?
Well, I think Max will stick on the Anglophile theme. The next is about another unique aircraft that was sort of at Oceana this year. It's a Scottish Aviation Bulldog, which is a trainer, the primary trainer used by the Royal Navy and the U.S. Excuse me, Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, and for all of their flight schools. It was recently retired. But it's a self-explanatory interview, so let's talk about the Bulldog.
I'm with Rob Tomlinson, standing in front of a red and white airplane that really doesn't fit in with the scheme of Naval Air Station Oceana. Rob, you want to tell me a little bit about what we're standing next to?
Well, we're standing next to a British Aerospace, formerly Scottish Aviation, Bulldog T1, which was a RAF primary trainer in the late 60s, throughout the 70s, 80s, 90s, and they were surplused in the 2000 time frame. This particular airplane was with the Bristol University Air Squadron and was surplused in 2001. It was brought into the U.S. Via Florida with the Valiant Air Command Museum in 2003, I believe. I picked up the airplane in 2004 and then did a cleanup job on it. It's pretty much exactly as it was in the RAF after it was surplused. All the markings are the same. I've just basically cleaned the airplane up, gone through it mechanically to make sure that it was airworthy, and then buffed out, you know, the dull paint and that type of thing. So it's fairly authentic in terms of the way an RAF trainer would have looked in Royal Air Force or Royal Navy training schemes during that time period. And by the way, this was not only just the Royal Air Force, it was the Royal Navy as well. This airplane was assigned to one of the squadrons that was a RNEFTS, or Royal Navy Elementary Flying Training Squadron, as well as a Royal Air Force training squadron. And also, this particular airplane was the fourth Bulldog that was actually made for RAF service. This is XX516, the fourth Bulldog that went into service, and it was actually one of the Bulldog aerobatic team aircraft as well in the 1970s. It was one of the four Bulldog aerobatic aircraft that did several air shows all over the UK in the late 70s, 78, 79 time frame. And also, once again, it was a Royal Navy trainer as well as an RAF trainer. So that's about it.
And how does she fly as an airplane?
It's a great flying airplane. It's aerobatic, does nice loops and rolls, and it's very docile on the controls. It's an excellent flying airplane. I very enjoy flying this airplane very much.
What other type ratings do you have? What's your career like?
Well, I'm actually a commercial pilot, and I have ratings in jets and Lear jets and Sabreliners, etc. I'm a former Air Force pilot, and I have flown F-4s, F-106s. I've also flown various other civilian jets. I've also owned a de Havilland Chipmunk and Tiger Moth as well. And this airplane is really one of my favorites because it's a very practical airplane. I can fly it to IFR. I can fly it. I can leave it out because it's all metal. I can leave it out on the ramp overnight and not be worried about the airplane, having hail damage or this type of stuff. It's just a very practical airplane, and it just is a lot of fun to fly in terms of just pure flying enjoyment.
before we started our conversation, I heard you say something about it has more hours doing touch and goes than it does flying, right?
Absolutely. Airplane has about 5,000 hours on it, but it has close to 50,000 landings in the logbook. So you can tell that the did a lot of takeoffs and landings. Or circuits and bump.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time. It's a cool airplane.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you so much. I enjoy bringing it to air shows. It's rare in the United States. I did find someone who was with the Cambridge University Air Squadron at one time, that this particular airplane was in the Cambridge University Air Squadron, and he actually flew this airplane. It was in his logbook. And I also talked to the highest time Bulldog instructor, who's now over here on the F-35 program up at Pax River Naval Air Station, and he has actually flown this airplane as well. So it's kind of fun, you know, running into British pilots that have a lot of history with this particular airplane.
And that, in this airplane, evidently has quite a lot of history. Well, thank you again very much, Rob.
Thank you. You're very welcome.
David, one of the things that just strikes me is sort of the depth of flying experience that a lot of these guys have. I mean, these guys have just been in a lot of amazing airplanes over the years, you know?
Yeah, I came away this weekend with a better appreciation of people like Rob who fly everything. And these guys have had flighter careers, and some of the conversations I've had off mic were equally fabulous. I could have spent a couple more hours just, you know, I need to find a bar somewhere, open up a bar and just and play bartender for all these guys and just serve them drinks so they can tell stories, because it's a great joy for me listening to all of their stories, you know.
Yeah, certainly.
Can I make, you know, it's an interesting point you make, David, because, you know, we have a flying club over here in Chicago that I belong to, and they're always trying to make it a, you know, more of a social club for flyers. And we had this English fellow come by beginning of the summer, and we were trying to talk about, you know, how we make it more social. And he said, oh, you know, he said, I didn't know how you make it more social. He's going to put a pub here, you know. All real flying clubs have pubs. He said, nobody cares if they fly. They just go to hang out at the pub and tell stories.
Right.
So, see, I think that fits right in with what you're going to do. We just need to have a pub where the people speak differently. You know, if they sounded like they were English, maybe it would work.
Maybe.
It's kind of fish stories, you know. You want to sit around. But these guys and gals, they like talking airplanes. And
the
guys that fly in the Warbirds, they've got long careers that they're enjoying their second life flying all of these great, cool aircraft. So it's really easy to interview these people. You just put a mic in front of them and say,
go
talk to me, and they just are willing to share so much. So
stuff.
I'm very lucky.
All right. Well, we have a couple more interviews that David did, and we'll try to get to those next episode. So again, thanks for these, David. These are really fantastic. And now with This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof again, our Airplane Geeks historian.
Well, Max, I'll be honest. I realized I screwed up last week, and I only did it to September 30th. So we're going to do a little catch-up. Bring us current. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 2, Episode 31, October 1st through October 9th. October 1st, 1947, George Welch, a test pilot for North American Aviation, breaks a sound barrier in XP-86. So why did General Chuck Yeager, who officially broke the sound barrier, get credit? Well, Welch broke the barrier in a dive from 35,000 feet. It was also reported there was a sonic boom heard over Murdoch Dry Lake on October 1st. Yeager did it 2 weeks later in level flight. There were also not verifiable ways to tell when Welch actually went supersonic. Yeager had the whole of the NACA watching his every stick action. Lastly, the United States Air Force forbid and classified the event so that neither Welch nor North American Aviation could speak of it until after a year. To this day, the U.S. Air Force says that since there was no way to verify it, the event didn't happen. Sounds like a lot like a New Zealander I know and his aircraft, huh, Grant? On October 4th, 1957, and maybe Rob could tell me what this was like, The world gets a new moon, 23 inches in diameter. Sputnik 1 becomes the first man-made satellite to orbit the Earth. It made a complete orbit in 96 minutes.
Ooh, I remember that. I remember that.
Yeah, well, yeah, that was quite a thing, yeah.
Yeah, and it beeped.
And that's about all it did, though, I think, right?
That's right. I think that is all it did.
All of the ham radio operators around the world tuned in so they could listen to it beep and go by.
Yeah, that's true.
47 years later, in 2004, Burt Rutan's Spaceship One returns to an orbit for a second time in 2 weeks. The flight is piloted by Brian Binney, who flew 367,442 feet, or 69.6 miles, or 112 kilometers, making him the second person to receive the FAA civilian astronaut wings. His time in space was less than 5 minutes, and Binney also became the first Scotsman to go into space. So Rob's conversation last week about going into orbit was should have been this week, but he waited till last week. And I think we calculated, what was it? It was, how much was it a second you were up in space, Rob?
It'd be $40,000, $40,000 a minute or something.
Yeah, and Beatty was also in space in under 5 minutes.
Yeah.
October 5th, 1931, Miss Vidal crashes in Washington State. No, this is not about an alcohol binge. Miss Vidal was piloted by Clyde Pangborn and Hugh Herndon. It was a Belanca J300 skyrocket capable of holding 800 gallons of fuel and was designed for long-distance flights. Pangborn and Herndon flew the Belanca to Japan to begin a around-the-world flight. Upon landing, they were taken captive under charges of spying. Pangborn had inadvertently taken pictures of several naval yards, and neither pilot had the proper passports or documentation for entry into Japan. While they were incarcerated, Pangborn and Herndon worked on increasing the range of Miss Vidal, and she eventually carried 950 gallons of fuel. The Japanese, who could not prove the spying, offered to grant them one takeoff. If they failed, they would be returned to prison. Quickly, they got in the airplane and took off on October 4th. Since the increased fuel was a necessary weight, they decided they would jettison the landing gear upon takeoff. Once done, Pangborn had to climb out of the aircraft and manually kick off the stubs because they wouldn't disengage from the aircraft. A belly landing occurred in Washington State after 41 hours and 15 minutes of flying, or 5,500 miles. Miss Vidal would become the first aircraft to fly the Pacific Ocean without stopping. Believe it or not, there is a replica. The Spirit of Wenatchee is being sent to Japan this year, so it will be there for the 80th anniversary of the flight next year. And they have a website, which is spiritofwenatchee.org, and we'll be happy to put that on the show notes.
How do you spell Wenatchee?
WENATCHEE.org.
Okay, thanks.
And flights that occurred the last week, during this week, the Bell OH-58D Kira Warrior, October 6, 1986. The Learjet 23, October 7th, 1963, and the Learjet 45, October 7th, 1996. And that's the way it was, October 1st through October 9th.
All right. Thank you, David. So, Dan, do you want to give us your 60-second summary of the week's M&A news?
Wow. Okay. Hold on. Give me a second.
Well, first, let me explain to our listeners that Dan Webb has joined us for a few minutes while we're in progress here. So, Dan, tell us what you think about the recent activity with Southwest and AirTran.
Okay. So United Continental closed on Friday. Now trading under UAL on New York Stock Exchange. Basically, merger closed, yay, still operating separately, and now the real work begins, and we'll see what product decisions they make work to come. Southwest AirTran, really exciting, very interesting to see Southwest taking on a different fleet type completely. We'll see how they use them. Will those 717s, be moved to more traditional Southwest hubs? What does it mean for Delta? I don't think it's as big a deal as some people are saying, just because Delta and AirTran have successfully coexisted for a while, and Southwest and Delta coexist in a few cities perfectly fine. We'll see what happens with Milwaukee, with Frontier. Does Southwest want two fairly large operations with Midway and Milwaukee next to each other? Is this a good thing for Frontier? Who knows? I think it is, but we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens with the pilots. There's a little SkyWest partnership in Milwaukee with a few CRJs, and I believe, I'm not sure what the Southwest pilot contract has on scope, but that's interesting, and I'm already over 60 seconds. Crap. Let me just add a couple last quick things. I want to see what happens with Delta just because, like, what happens to people who fly AirTran in business class? Do they stay with, you know, AirTran and go over Southwest, or they go to Delta?
Yeah.
There are a bunch of small cities that AirTran has service to, some of which, I mean, AirTran's been pretty good with, like, revenue guarantees. Southwest hasn't really been a player in that game until recently with Panama City, so we'll see how that goes. And the other thing I'm interested in is Southwest has picked up, and this is something I was just thinking about today, has picked up slots at National and LaGuardia. And I guess I'm wondering is how will they use those? For example, like AirTran and LaGuardia has service to, Akron, Atlanta, Indianapolis, Milwaukee, Newport News, Orlando. So I'm wondering, you know, are those safe or can Southwest use those slots more effectively? So like something like, I don't know, Akron, Canton, it would make, I mean, I really haven't looked at the data to see how it's performing. That something would make me just, it would make me think that Southwest could maybe use those slots in a more traditional business market. So, and there are a couple slots at National as well that AirTran's using to Florida and Atlanta. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see how Southwest plays around with everything. And I think there are some very interesting implications with Boeing and Bombardier and possibly Embraer, with, you know, what eventually happens to replace those 717s, but, you know, we could have a whole huge discussion about that, so I'll be quiet now.
All right, well, very good.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, October 3rd, 2010.
Well, g'day folks, it's Steve here, back for the Australia Desk for episode 117. Can you believe it, Grant? It's getting on. How are you, mate?
Yeah, not too bad, mate, not too bad. Back home in Melbourne, there are only a few days of cold, but the last few days have been absolutely gorgeous. Blue skies, a little bit of wind, and a warm, warm, warm day.
Yeah, well, of course, I feel a little bit robbed this morning because we've flicked over to daylight savings today, so we've lost an hour of sleep, so I'm tired and cranky.
Oh, and this is different how? Oh,
yeah,
sorry.
I was going to say, I'm always tired and cranky. Ask anyone that knows me.
Ah, well, I was a little cranky to have come back to Melbourne. We spent about 2 hours in the air flying from the Gold Coast down to Melbourne and dropped about 12 or 13 degrees Celsius.
Yes, a beautiful one day, perfect the next in Queensland and back here to chilly old Melbourne. It's funny, it's been a chilly week, and then as you say, it's quite nice weather today. So that's good news, but I'll tell you what isn't such good news as the warmer weather approaches. Victoria, New South Wales and South Australia, the three states in the southeastern corner of this country, are preparing for a huge plague of locusts.
Yeah, that's right, mate. It's not looking real good for people growing crops in those three states. We're going to have quite the horde of locusts. Indications are that they're up to 50 kilometres long, the swarms. When I was flying balloons in the Mildura area in July, the story coming down from just to the north in New South Wales, Mildura being right on the border, was that one shovelful of soil was found to have contained about 1,000 locust eggs. So they're really expecting a massive hatching. They're doing a lot of aerial spraying with aircraft, fixed wing and helicopters. They're waiting until the locusts have actually hatched and boiled up out of the ground, and then they spray them while they're drying themselves before they really start flying. But it's that flying part that's giving the problems. CASA have actually put out a warning saying to aviators in the area to be cautious because of the locust plague. They swarm, they can go up to 3,000 feet in the air. They can block pitot tubes on the ground as well, so making sure all engine cowlings and pitot tubes and so on are covered. And if you're flying and see one, just go for altitude and get away from them, because you can lose visibility with them splatting on the screen, and they can really foul up the works. There have been cases of locusts taking down aircraft in the past.
In fact, they're saying swarms of up to 50 million of them, Grant, flying it up to about 3,000 feet. So yep, we're coming out of drought conditions here. We've had quite a severe drought here probably for the better part of the last decade. But of course, this winter that we've just come out of in this part of the world has actually been a pretty standard winter. So we've had a lot of rain, which is fantastic. It's good to see the dams filling up, and it's good for our farmers. But on the downside, these sort of insects have been laying dormant for a long time. And it's quite often a problem. But of course, you know, having been a drought and not having to deal with these sort of insects SpaceX for such a long time. It's kind of a new phenomenon. So the only other thing I'd say is that if the Civil Aviation Safety Authority is out there issuing NOTAMs about their locusts, I certainly hope they've got some inspectors out there checking all those locusts for, you know, if they're flying, they should have a license as well, shouldn't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, are they going to give them an RAOS ultralight license?
Yeah. Who do they think they are?
Yeah.
Well, Grant, speaking of droughts that we've had, we had a drought of Virgin Blue aircraft during the week due to a computer failure. I guess they had a drought of computerness as well.
Yeah, and they certainly had some bugs in the system.
Oh, God, we're firing today.
I had to say it. but that's right. On Sunday, Virgin Blue had a massive outage of their booking system that they use at the check-in spots. That system, supplied by Navitaire, a subsidiary of Accenture, failed when a solid-state disk system died. And apparently, Navitaire tried to restart the system instead of going straight to the backup. So instead of bringing over a backup within an hour or so, they wound up taking 21 hours to restore the situation.
Now, this couldn't have come at a worse time, really, because it's school holidays down here at the moment. On top of that, the major football codes here, that's Australian Rules Football and Rugby League, are all in final series. So there's a lot of people trying to travel around the country, particularly here on the eastern seaboard. And so people were not happy. Let's have a listen to a few less than impressed passengers.
The only thing we've been told is that all the Virgin Blue systems have been shut down in Australia wide.
I think it's chaos. And I think we should be told what's going on.
I just want to go home. Been here for too long now.
Why don't they have a backup system? I mean, this can happen any time. It's ridiculous.
Well, like you said, Grant, they did have a backup system, but why wouldn't they switch that over? I mean, you're the IT guy. You would think that they'd have several fallbacks in place in case something like this happened.
Well, typically you do have a failover system set up. Depending on the criticality of the system, you either have a hot live system that cuts over within seconds, or you have one that takes a little bit longer to cut over. For instance, in this case, I believe Navitaire have up to 3 hours to cut over. So while that does cause chaos and problems at the booking and check-in front end, it's something that can be picked up within a day or so. But this one took 21 hours, and that's got IT people around the world scratching their head because Navitaire announced that they tried to repair the solid-state disk array rather than going for the backup. So this is going to be very interesting. Borghetti is an avowed fan of Amadeus, the booking system that Qantas and many other airlines use, as well as Virgin Australia. And the word is that he's got his lawyers sharpening their pencils into ultra-fine points. They're going through the contract and looking to find out if this is breach of contract that would allow Virgin to walk away from the New Skies system and switch to something else, or at least get a whole lot of money out of Navitaire.
Yeah, well, of course, the Amadeus system has not been without its share of problems this year. I mean, it was back in January or February, Grant, I think it was, that Qantas and many other airlines around the world were having problems with Amadeus. I can remember when Qantas took over Australian Airlines, and there was a lot of unhappiness on the Australian Airlines side at that time because they felt that their system, which was called Tarzan, was being taken over and rolled into Amadeus. I know some people that worked quite closely with that system at that time, and apparently the Tarzan system was way superior to Amadeus even back then.
Oh, look, Amadeus has the reputation for being the lumbering giant of the booking systems. They are doing a lot to improve their act, but they're generally behind a lot of other people, and it wouldn't surprise me to hear that they were cherry-picking systems out of Tarzan to try and improve their operation.
Well, the interesting thing is that at the same time that this happened, oddly enough, Jetstar also had some computer glitches this week. Are they using the same system?
They and many other low-cost carriers are using the New Skies system from Navitaire. Jetstar had 2 15-minute outages. There may have been a root cause outage that affected everyone that then caused an instability in that RAM disk cluster that Virgin are using. Perhaps that was a dedicated machine just for Virgin, because what it does is it caches database accesses and things like that. So it would not be surprising to find that you've got one for each airline that they then plug into just to share the load. It may be that just the box that was servicing Virgin went down.
Well, Grant, all this talk of computers, and we might be able to sell this segment to Leo Laporte the way we're going.
Oh, mate, we wish.
My close personal friend. Anyway, Grant, speaking of computers and all things geeky, just before we go, it looks like Qantas is looking to set up its own 787 simulators over here in Australia.
That's correct. There are many 787 simulators being set up in Shanghai and many other parts of Asia, as well as in Europe and the US, but Qantas have decided they want to have their own in Sydney. Understandable, they have their own simulators for all the other aircraft, and they are going to be a major operator of the 787. So it wouldn't surprise me to see them setting up their own internal sims here, and then, of course, leasing them out. They did the same with the 737 next-gen sims that they had down here in Melbourne. The first one was kept quite busy training Qantas and Virgin pilots.
That's interesting, Grant. It's saying that they've bought two 787 simulators, in fact, from a Canadian company called CAE.
That's right.
They're going to set them, they're going to set themselves up here and most likely in Sydney, according to this report that we're looking at here in The Australian.
That's right. Typically, Qantas have their long-haul simulators in Sydney and their domestic simulators and shorter routes and so on down here in Melbourne, which is why at first they had the A330 sim and the 787 sim down here in that rather beautiful-looking building just next to Essendon Airport. But I think they moved the A330s up to Sydney at one point when more of their long-haul staff were flying A330s, not just domestic. But it wouldn't surprise me at all to find the 787 there. That's where they already have the 74 and the A3. I believe they have an A380 simulator there as well.
Yeah, they're saying these simulators are worth about $20 million US each. So,
That's about 18 million Australian dollars the way we're going at the moment.
I'll tell you, the way the dollar's going, it's looking pretty. Heck, you know, Grant, we should get over to the States for a holiday. We could almost afford it right now.
Oh, mate, it's getting that way. For a little bit longer, it's going to be just like the heyday of the 70s when the Aussie dollar was more than the US dollar and they were selling American magazines for their cover price because that cover price in Australian dollars actually included the cost of shipping and everything.
Oh, the good old days. Well, anyway, folks, that's about everything we have for you here on the Australia Desk for this week. Grant, I think I'm going to get outside and get out into the sunshine.
Oh, I certainly am, mate.
Yeah, you can always tell when the weather starts finding up here, Grant, because I live right in the middle of the training area for our local airport at Moorabbin, and but looking outside at the moment, there are Cessnas and Piper Warriors going in all directions. Lucky sods.
traffic. Mate, I've had times on beautiful days when I've been out in training areas and I've spent more time calling traffic than I have flying the aircraft, and that's when we generally turn around and go somewhere else or go back.
There you go. Well, one thing I won't be doing this week is watching Fox News. Did you hear Rob Mark was on the TV? I hope they don't show that edition here.
Oh, man. Did they do consumer product warnings for that?
I wonder what the rating was.
Rated.
Okay, I think we've upset Rob as much as we can this week. Until next week, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarron.
Cheers, folks.
Actually, they can work much harder to upset me. That hardly upset me at all.
Well, it's because I've trained you well.
Yeah, it's true.
Actually, Rob, here's one thing you need to be on Fox News about, because I'd be interested to hear your opinion. But have you guys heard of this new augmented reality iPhone app that uses ADS-B data? And basically, I think it's really cool. You basically hold up your iPhone and it uses the camera and it, you know, figures out where you are. And I had a cool app that used augmented reality when I was in D.C. And it would just show, like, where the nearest subway station is and how to get there. But this one uses ADS-B software and then says, like, well, you know, X number of miles away, there's this flight pointing, you know, if we look in front of your iPhone. And there was they mentioned it briefly on Fox News this morning, and there's another media coverage saying, you know, is this a terrorist threat? And I'm like, really? Do you guys ever go on FlightAware? Well, or any other flight tracking site?
You know, I mean, they're nice folks. I mean, they always treat me nicely, but, you know, the Fox people do tend to be just a bit more aware of bad guys.
That's very
diplomatic.
Yeah. How does one show up on Fox News, Rob? Did they call you or did you call them?
Yeah. Oh, no. They call me. actually, I have to admit that was one of the benefits of Jetwine. They started calling me a couple of years ago. Somebody read something. I forgot what the story was. And we started working together. And that's kind of, and the CNN people found me because of the Fox people.
Mm, sure.
So, you know, one builds on the other.
Will we be seeing more of you on television?
Well, you never know. That could be a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, when do you get an hour of prime time?
Well, you know, since CNN fired Rick Sanchez, I'm kind of hoping they're going to call me. But that may not happen.
Rob, on the mark.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. There it is. There's the name of the show. Okay, moving on to some listener mail. We got a message from Micah. Micah, of course, is Harriet's son. Micah wrote in to say that Harriet's doing well. She should be leaving the hospital to return home any day now, and that she's doing well, recovering, and he says her spirits are up. Harriet is our favorite 80-year-old listener and has recently had a major operation, so it's always good to hear that Harriet's doing well, and we wish her a speedy recovery. One of the things that I liked about Micah's note was that he mentioned that in the hospital, her bed was by the window, and she was looking out of her window, and she saw a plane flying by and called Micah to the window so that he could look and see the plane. Micah writes that, "I guess I just wanted to let you know that, sick or not, Harriet is, without a doubt, an airplane geek. How lucky I am to have her as my mom."
That is awesome.
Yeah, absolutely, huh? We also got a note from Brad. This actually came in a week ago, but we didn't have a chance to mention it last week. Brad writes that he enjoys the podcast. He listens to us going home from work. Brad says that he was born an airplane geek because his father is a pilot, now retired. He flew in the Utah Air Guard and in an F-86 and later the F-100. After that, he got a job with United Airlines, started on the DC-6 and ended on the 747-400. Brad says he has many aviation stories growing up and many aviation experiences. He said, like the time he turned the lights out to half of Las Vegas. And I'm not sure exactly how that happened. Brad says he's gone to many air shows, loves the Reno air races, and says that he used to fly up to Reno in his friend's Bonanza F-33, which is a little rocket. So thanks to Brad for writing that in. I think Brad is kind of typical of a lot of our listeners, real airplane geeks with lots of aviation in their blood. We also got a note from Tim. Tim was looking for some advice in advance. Tim says that he really loves the show. He's trying to get caught up on some past podcasts, but he's also planning a trip to Scotland. He hopes he can get caught up there. Tim was wondering if we could do a little feature on using camcorders in general aviation aircraft. He says there seems to be a lack of knowledge sharing on the internet on just how to incorporate internal comms into a camcorder. Let's see, he says it's clearly possible as there are lots of excellent examples on podcasts, i.e. the student pilot log. When I think of guys who do audio and video well in airplanes, and not just general aviation, but almost anything, I think of Steve Tupper over at Airspeed. And so I think that's probably one of the best sources for that kind of technical help and information. I don't know, do you guys have any other suggestions for Tim?
No, actually, Tupper was the one I was going to suggest because Steve is, if you look at some of the videos that he's done with, they're doing their aerobatic school, acro school, they're calling it, and they've done all the in-cockpit videos, and it's wonderful stuff. And I have no idea how it works. I think it's all magic, but Steve would know. In fact, before we sign off, I'll see if I can find Steve's email, and we'll put it in here for Tim.
And Tim, just so you know, before I did my video when I went up with the Golden Knights, I gave a shout out to Mr. Tupper, and he's really friendly, knows a lot, and he'll be perfectly happy to help you. So Tupper's a good guy all around.
All right. We also heard from Stéphane, is I think how you pronounce it. It's probably wrong, but I'll go with Stéphane. He says he's a loyal listener from Ireland. He discovered the show about 5 months ago. He's been hooked ever since. Actually, he says he's quite a nervous flyer, but he's trying to overcome that fear. And along the way, he's developed a huge interest in commercial aviation, he says. So he's getting ready to fly to Canada for a couple of days, and he's a bit nervous about his flights and looking for any advice in that regard. I think... fear of flying or nervousness on flight may be more common than maybe people realize. Any of you guys have any suggestions?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when I flew for a living, I used to have to deal with this all the time.
Oh, okay.
This fear of flying. I mean, because I'm afraid of heights. And so the way I overcame it is when I flew, I just didn't look out the window.
Okay, yeah. You change your frame of reference, as it were.
And what else helps?
You're a pilot afraid of heights.
Who won't look out the window?
My wife, the shrink, tells me that I'm a pilot afraid of heights because I wanted to conquer that fear. And that's why I learned to fly.
Wow. What, that's a heartwarming story.
Yeah. But, so here's my question. If you didn't look out the window, how did you land?
Land?
Yeah, or do anything.
That's what you have a co-pilot for.
Oh, I see.
So, and actually, you know what else worked very well when you're on those international flights and they give you those little blindfoldy things with the elastic?
Yeah, for sleeping.
You know, to sleep with?
Yeah, right.
Those are really, really great because those will help you get past the fear of anything.
The only thing I suggest, like, and I think it's sort of along what Rob suggested, is I kind of like it now. It's sort of changed. I'm less of a nervous flyer than I used to be. Is I would do that, but you know, pop on the noise canceling headphones and you know, pop on some music or something, and just you know, that way if you have something to distract you, it's usually
distraction.
Better.
All right, we also heard from Richard. This is the same guy we talked about last week. Richard was the one that did the kind of cross country tour of the U.S. stopping at a lot of aviation kinds of locations. Yeah, Richard wrote back again, and we'd commented, or maybe Rob had commented on the amount of traveling he'd done across the U.S., and Richard says, yes, Rob, many thousands of miles on the two cars I've used. He says, now I can claim I've listened to all editions of the Airplane Geeks and Plane Crazy Down Under, a great way to catch up on all things in the sky. Also, having completed this trip, which involves South Africa, Southern African states, Australia, and part of New Zealand, Hong Kong, 10 airlines, and a few thousand air miles, probably a few tens of thousands of air miles, now it's time to go home and pay for it all. So if all of his globe-trotting, Richard commented that the best flight that he took, at least long haul, was Qantas from Johannesburg to Sydney. He says, way too close to Antarctica for me. And some short tourist flights that were remarkable for him. Kenmore Airlines around Seattle in a float plane. That sounds like a lot of fun. A Eurocopter flight onto the Franz Josef Glacier in New Zealand. It also sounds like a spectacular adventure. So thanks to Richard for writing in.
Think of the frequent flyer miles.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. And Tim, I've got that Steve Tupper email. Steve@airspeedonline, one word, airspeedonline.com. Tell him the geek people sent you.
Yeah, and everybody, if you haven't seen this, Steve's work on Airspeed, it's worth taking a look at. He does a lot of audio podcasts and a great number of video podcasts as well from a lot of very exciting airplanes, aerobatic, military, all kinds of stuff. So check out Steve's work.
Yeah, and you'd never know that he was an attorney by trade.
I know, he's a lawyer. Can you believe it?
Yeah, the lawyer jokes. Anyway.
All right, I think that's the show. We want to thank Steve Frischling, Fish, for joining us again. You can find his blog at flyingwithfish.com, and you can also find his travel strategist site at thetravelstrategist.com. Thanks also to Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron for the Plane Crazy Down Under Australia Desk Report. See them at planecrazydownunder.com. Okay, this is the part of the show where we get to promote ourselves and what we do. So, Rob, why don't you start off? Tell people where they can find more of you online.
More of me? Yeah, there we go. What's really scary is the Fox people never asked me if I was a Democrat or a Republican, so I think that's a good thing.
That is a good thing.
Which these days I'm not sure anyway. But you can find me at jetwine.com. And in fact, you'll find Scott Spangler and I both on Twitter at jetwine. And for those who may be going to the NBAA show next week, we'll see you in NBAA in Atlanta.
And David Vanderhoof, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at DMVanderhoof. You can find me not on Fox News, and you can find me on my blog at whatjustflewby.com.
And finally, Dan Webb, how about you?
There's only one way to find me, and it requires that you believe in love and a little bit of magic.
Clicking your heels three times, huh, kiddo?
But no, in reality, find me on my blog, thingsinthesky.com, and please tweet me. I love Twitter so much. Dan Wenage.
Very good. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter at Max Flight. Be sure to visit us at airplanegeeks.com. You can order t-shirts, leave some comments, read the comments left by other listeners. You can also write us at thegeeks at airplanegeeks.com. And of course, we have a Facebook fan page at Airplane Geeks.
I always want to say thank you for everyone who's fanned us on Facebook. It's a nice growing group, and I think we have great discussions going on every week.
Yeah, it is growing, and it is kind of an easier way to communicate than the comments on the webpage. It's a lot more interactive and a little bit more meaningful conversation.
I think what's good is, and sorry to cut you off, is that because it gives you the notification when someone else has replied. So unlike the comments when you have to go and check, I mean, Facebook, it's going to, you know, say, hey, someone responded. So I think that's cool. But no, we're 260, so let's hope maybe the next week or two we can hit the big 300.
Cool. All right. Folks can also leave us a voicemail on our listener line.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Okay, I think that's it for this episode. Be sure to join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks.
Bye. Good night, Harriet.
Anyone else? No one?
Well, I...
No one. Bueller?
Yeah. Bueller.
Dan? Oh, that's right. He's not here tonight.
I see Mr. Webb has snuck in.
What's that?
Hi, Dan.
Dan!
Just to utilize the late 1990 Super Bowl commercial reference. I feel old.
How are you?
Good. How are you guys?
All right.
How old do you feel?
20.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And New York was good, Dan?
New York was absolutely fantastic. It was a nice little school trip, and really, really good. I actually got to meet some of the folks from NYC Aviation, so fun time.
Yeah, did you meet Phil?
Yeah.
So we've been marching right along with the show. It seems to go faster without you.
Oh, thank you.
Sorry. It's a cheap shot, I know.
And by the way, Rob, I was talking to my mother today.
Yes.
And she goes, she says, you know, there is this really nice gentleman on. Well, I shouldn't say nice. I don't know what she said. She said, but there's this guy on Fox News talking about Denver and the shooting range near the airport. And I was like, that's Rob. So anyway, my mother now knows who you are.
Well, they're nice gentlemen. I like that, I think.
I thought you were very gentlemanly looking in front of the Fox cameras, Rob.
Well, I was prepared. I did some research on the fellow, though, before I went on the air. So at least an idea of where he – I'm sorry. At least I had an idea of where he kind of fit on the whole thing. So,
well, at least one of you was prepared.
There was more to the story than just the firing range.
Yeah.
So if there's you, Rob, and David here, where is our guest currently?
He's already gone.
Oh.
I told you we were moving along.
I know. I was under the impression we were going to talk about some M&A right now, but apparently not.
No, we did that already.
Nah.
There's nothing left to talk about.
Really?
We were about to go on the wah, 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 you know, whatever that didgeridoo thing.
Didgeridoo.
So if you talk about the fact that you used to play it, would you say that you didgeridid?
That's right.
Either that or you didgeridone.
A didgeridone.
Didgeridone. Yeah.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Oh, I forgot to push the button.
And we're live.
Oh, hang on. I'm just updating the wiki. Wiki. For a good time, call wiki. On 300 wiki. Okay, are we ready?
Recommended by Dave Higdon's everywhere. No, he's always picking it. He's always making that strange noise.
Wiki.
Dateline, October 3rd, 2010.
Oh, sorry, it dropped there, mate. You had a little bit of packet loss here.
Oh, no, not the packet loss. I'm hunting the packet. Pick up the tube.
It went 3rd, 2010.
Oh, okay. I've disconnected the downloader, so it can't be that.
All I am is a series of speed bumps for the progress of the show.